I'm Don.
And I'm Kate.
And welcome to Because Reasons,
a multimedia redemption podcast
where we take your beloved guilty pleasures in movies, books, and more
and decide whether or not
they're worthless trash. Hello, and welcome back to Because Reasons. I'm Don.
And I'm Kate.
And we're here to decide whether or not your favorite guilty pleasures are actually worthless trash.
So speaking of trash.
Oh, just launching right in, aren't you?
Just launching right in.
So we told you guys last episode, episode two, that we were going to be doing a book review this time. Because we said that this is a multimedia redemption podcast, and we mean that. So we decided to take a recent literary favorite of sort of American culture and give it the old Because Reasons review. So we did our due diligence and we read the book and we've had feelings about our book.
Such feelings.
And we decided that we'd come and sit down and chat to you lovely folks about this book. Now, as some preface, this is Nicholas Sparks we're talking about. So we both went into this with an understanding of who Nicholas Sparks was. What other books or movies or whatever of Nicholas Sparks had you read before?
I hadn't read any of his books.
Have you ever, like, seen The Notebook?
I saw The Notebook. I saw Walk to Remember. I didn't care for either of those.
Really? Why?
I just don't tend to like schmaltzy, heartwarming love story movies.
Okay. See, now this is bad for you, then.
This was. These are just hours of my life I could not get back from reading this.
Okay, now here's the thing. To be fair, and this is why Kate and I do this show together. She does not like heartwarming, schmaltzy movies.
No.
From October to January, my television is pretty much Lifetime Channel movies.
Oh.
And Hallmark movies.
No,
like,
no, no.
I will do the Hallmark Christmas movie. I will do, oh my god, the Good Witch movie series on Lifetime. Oh man, that's my bread and butter. I love a good schmaltz. I love it. It's like, oh my god, I love it. It's wonderful.
No.
It fills my cup. Why don't you like romance?
I don't dislike romance, but I don't
do
like characters
people?
That are so fake that it's worthless.
So what romance stories do you like? Like, that are actually, the central theme is romance, rather than, you know, these two people happen to fall in love in the middle of a zombie apocalypse. You know, that's
okay.
Not a romance. That's
stories that are actually about will they or won't they.
I mean, like, a classic movie.
Pride and Prejudice.
Okay.
I like that.
Okay.
Because it's realistic people.
Is that romance? Romance genre?
It is, because the whole point of the book is, will they or won't they get together?
Okay.
She has
to
be married by the end of the book.
Okay, and that was something, so our book club did a Jane Austen month, and we started off with
Persuasion,
and that was awful.
That was awful. Nothing happened. Nothing happened.
I think I actually was painting my house at the time, and I preferred sitting there watching that paint dry.
As opposed to
finishing that book.
Well, at least something's happening.
There you go. So you don't like romance?
I don't hate romance. I hate unrealistic romance. It's just so mindless. You can just eat it with a spoon. It's like this. If I turn on the Hallmark Channel, because I've tried this, my family loves Hallmark.
Okay,
you don't understand. My parents will watch the same Hallmark movie over and over. My dad loves Nicholas Sparks. Loves every book that comes out. He'll read it. He'll see the movie. And I've tried, but the problem is they're so formulaic and predictable, and it's always, oh, the couple, and they're kind of different, but oh, they have these similarities.
Okay, I want to throw out a couple. I want to just throw out a title of some kind of media that is a romance.
Okay.
And I want to see if you like it or you don't like it.
Oh, dear.
Okay. I just kind of want to get a litmus test for how much you dislike the romance genre in general.
Okay.
Ever After.
Eh.
Okay, no. Yay or nay here, sister?
I'll go with nay.
Really?
To be fair, it might not be the movie's fault. I haven't seen it since it came out, and I was quite young at the time.
Tristan and Isolde.
Haven't seen it.
Okay. How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
All right, I'm ashamed, but I do like that movie. It's just so funny.
Okay. See,
it's so funny. If you're going to have a crummy premise with cardboard people, at least make it funny.
No, you throw out Pride and Prejudice, and I would think that, you know, to How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, like, Ever After would be that version's of that version.
But
Pride
I haven't
and Prejudice.
Seen that since I was young. I don't have it in an adult context. Okay. I barely remember it.
Any Disney princess movie.
Yeah, I love Disney princess movies. Do I agree that they're healthy role models for your romance? No, but they're fun.
Okay, so other Nicholas Sparks votes. So you didn't like The Notebook?
No.
Why?
I just didn't like it. I just didn't care for the characters. I didn't find their passionate romance that moving, really.
Okay. Like, I'm almost dumbfounded. Like,
well,
that,
no,
was,
the
see,
idea
that was like Nicholas
of it was
Sparks'
okay.
heyday. That's why he's famous, is The Notebook and A Walk to Remember. The
ideas
the book, not
behind
the movie.
Them are okay, but I don't find his writing particularly believable.
Well, I mean, in a romance, there's a certain... I mean, of course, in literature in general, there's just a certain suspension of
And I've tried.
Disbelief with things. I mean, things have to work out in just the right way for the hero and the heroine to come together.
I know, and I try it with most things, but something about his particular... It's a lot like Thomas Kincaid. If you look at his paintings, like, okay, they're good. You can tell it's a cottage. Sure, that's believable. Yes, that's a nice application of colors. Yes, that is exactly how a wooded glade would be lit. I really hate it. See, technically, it's a picture. It makes sense. It's a well-rendered picture. But something about that contrived, just schmaltzy way of putting that picture together, you can tell that it's disingenuous. This isn't he wrote it because he felt this profound, moving love story and he wanted to share it with the world. He didn't wrestle with these characters in his head trying to give them life on the page. It was, okay, so I want to make money. And I ideally want my book to be a movie. Hmm.
Well, I mean, at this
what
point...
What can I put together?
At this point, pretty much every Nicholas Sparks movie
But you
is,
can tell that that's how it is. It
is
wasn't something
movie.
He loved. It was, this will make me money... So I should write this.
So, okay. So, given that you do not like the romance genre,
I don't hate romances. I don't naturally gravitate towards them.
Okay. I mean, that's fair.
I've enjoyed them, but I don't seek them out.
Okay. Is there one that you really like? Like, what is your ideal romance story? Movie, book, whatever. Is there something out there that you do, you know, in the back of your head say, oh, well, it's not as good as 16 Candles. It's
I don't know about, like... That,
I mean, sure, The Craft is a paragon of cult movie fiction, but it's no Teen Witch.
I don't know that I have one that I think is really
They're remaking
great.
The Craft.
They need
Hollywood.
To stop.
Listen, that's a terrible idea. I'm just... Sorry.
Unless they get Fairuza Balk.
Fairuza Balk needs to be
I
the person.
Her.
She needs to be the person that owns the witchy shop.
But gives them the book.
Yes!
Here, impressionable children, take this.
Okay, so what is your paragon of romance?
I don't know that I have a paragon of what I think is, like, spectacularly done.
Is it Doug and Sally Mayonnaise?
No. Well, no, and here's my problem with having the romance genre in general. There are tons of great classic books out there that are just considered fiction, even though they're based around a love premise. I mean, Jane Eyre is technically a romance, because it's about will they or won't they get together, but it's considered literature, because it's not just that. So when most books are categorized as, oh, well, it's like saying something's just a chick flick novel, or a chick flick movie, it's the same thing with, oh, it's just a romance book. You sort of anticipate it to be kind of crummy and poorly done with cardboard characters.
So, okay, so we decided to read the book, and it...
And also, to be fair, I tried to really be open-minded taking it in, because I thought maybe... Well, no, I'd never read his books before.
There's
I was
somebody
trying to
right
think,
now that is driving in their minivan, listening to us through speakers going, the F she did.
No, I tried because I'd never read a book. No, I tried to think maybe the movie versions, they just horribly just messed up his stories. Maybe at heart, there's at least good writing.
I mean, he did say that he was like the next great American author. Didn't he say that he was better than Hemingway, I think, at one point?
Something like that. Yeah. So I tried to read it with the in mind of, I haven't read them before. Maybe the actual book is good and the movies were just, you know, Hollywood's interpretation of his wonderful stories.
Okay, so give us a quick rundown of the basic premise, the characters of The Longest Ride by Nicholas Sparks. And again, we are talking about the book today. We're not talking about the movie. And I will say, I've not seen the movie yet.
No, neither have I.
So we're not gonna, and I don't think I will.
Neither will I.
Scott Eastwood is very pretty.
But no.
But no.
No. So it's sort of a side-by-side story between this Jewish man named Ira and his wife Ruth, and sort of their...
Who is dead. Is kind of a ghost.
And talking to him while he's crashed his car and waiting for help.
Possibly a death a deathbed hallucination.
But they keep flashing back to the story, like, as he's, you know, in this car waiting for rescue. He's flashing back on, oh, how we met and how we started dating mm-hmm. and getting together and him going through the war. So it's their story told side by side with a current day story of a college senior named Sophia and a rodeo bull rider named Luke. And as they meet...
And of course, Sophia means wisdom. And of course, she's the smart one of the relationship.
Yeah.
Because we are Charles Dickens and we name people after the thing that they are.
Yeah. They could also have named her Prudence.
Chastity.
Or Caution.
Oh, except for a week. Sorry. We'll get there.
But it's basically the side-by-side story of how these couples both meet, their relationship, I'm using air quotes, develop, and then the ultimate resolution. And in typical Hallmark movie fashion, they meet, the couples are both already kind of in love with each other when they meet. Everything is perfect and wonderful. There's a slight misunderstanding, and it easily gets resolved by the end. This happens in both stories, by the way.
Well, one story, I mean, here's the thing. It's a Nicholas Sparks novel, and I have actually read some Nicholas Sparks novels back in high school when Mandy Moore was one of my many teen idols, which now you can tell how old I am. Very old. Very, very old. She was breaking into acting with her first big movie role in A Walk to Remember. So, of course, I read the book. And, oh, God, I cried.
Really?
Oh, man. Oh, God. I was, like, 15, 16, oh, yeah. Something. Oh, it was the perfect, like, teen... And it's about teenagers in high school. So, I mean, it's a whole thing. But, and the thing is, the book is actually pretty dang good.
I can't speak to the book. I haven't read it.
It's a pretty dang good book. I've read The Notebook. I've seen The Notebook. I don't know that I've read too many other Nicholas Sparks novels. I think I've read one more, but I don't recall what it was. And I have seen a couple more of his novels, like Safe Harbor. I've seen that one with Julianne Hough. And I've seen a couple others. So, I mean, so I have kind of Nicholas Sparks's theme down. It's going to start off with an old person. This old person is either going to flash back to when he was young and tell the story of a young couple, or there's going to be an old person, and then there's going to be a story about a young couple. Oh, surprise twist, the old person at the beginning of the novel is secretly the guy from the young story. Or, like in this novel, there's going to be an old person and a young couple, and eventually they're going to meet, and I think we should go ahead and say right now.
Because you have to appeal to all of the demographics between about 15 and 80.
We should go ahead and say right now this podcast is going to be full of spoilers. So,
which you should know.
Giant spoiler alert. Nicholas Sparks, no matter what you're reading or watching, the old person is going to die so that the young person's life becomes better.
Well, because there has to be that touching moment and you cry and... Oh, I mean, wasn't it beautiful?
It doesn't matter what story, how he does it. The ending is always the old person dies. and the young person's life is made better by this old person dying. It's just kind of how it is. So I had read, I knew enough of Nicholas Sparks to know it. And the thing is, I have enjoyed Nicholas Sparks to varying degrees over the years. I really enjoyed The Notebook. I thought it was a very original and heartfelt and heartwarming romance and stuff. But after a while, he just sort of plugs in names for characters and changes the setting.
Yes, because he's Hallmark.
Sort of, yeah. I mean, you know, Hallmark Movie Channel could pretty much...
It's the same story.
Just run
over
Nicholas
and
Sparks
over
movies.
And over. You could pick up midway through this story, you're not losing much.
So you have, I almost called them Herb and Dorothy, Ira and Ruth.
Yes.
And you have Ira and Ruth, and they're going back through. And the thing that I was noticing about the love story of Ira and Ruth, which is supposed to be sort of the heart of the novel, it is set in the past, obviously, when Ira and Ruth are young.
It is more believable
they're coming
than
up.
The modern day
There's
love story.
There's a reason why it's more believable. We'll get to it in just a second. But Ira and Ruth are falling in love, and they have a typical, you know, kind of romantic, you know, old person love story. You know, it's just, it's full of 1950s goodness.
Where
and,
he walks her home from synagogue with her parents walking 10 feet behind them.
Yes, it's darling, it's precious. And yeah. They grow up together, and they grow old together, and they get a career. And they fall in love over art. And that's wonderful. We like art.
Yes.
We like art. We enjoy art. And it's they start going to a certain college, and they help to cultivate artists by buying their work early. And, you know, flash forward several decades, and they own, you know, hundreds of paintings that are just all over their house by artists that they have been buying, some that went on to make big, big names for themselves, and some that were just, you know, because they liked the painting. But they slowly built up, you know, one of the largest privately held collections of modern American art in the world. And the funny thing is, I like to keep up with current events. And the more I was reading this novel, the more I was thinking, I've read this story. And I kept checking, like, the book, and I kept checking online to see, is this supposed to be an autobiography? Like, was he just novelizing their story? Because I thought, I mean, this is a thing. These people existed. And at first I thought maybe their names really were Ira and Ruth. Because a few years ago, those of you that you know, keep up with current events and things that are happening in pop culture and stuff, may have remembered that a big story came out a few years ago about a couple named Herb and Dorothy Vogel that actually were a sweet little couple from New England. Except, you know, she wasn't, you know, Herb wasn't, what was Herb in the book? Or no, Ira. What was Ira in the book?
A haberdasher.
Yeah,
which
he wasn't a haberdasher.
Which, of course, is something that you would do in a book.
He wasn't a haberdasher. No, Herb and Dorothy Vogel were civil servants. I think she was a librarian. They really did go and purchase art. But, you know, Dorothy didn't die in some tragic accident. She was still alive. And we know this because they made a documentary about Herb and Dorothy Vogel that came out a few years ago. They have since died. Herb did.
Quite on an age.
Yes. But they actually did have this story. And you went and, you know, the documentary took you into their house and you saw literally like every inch of their walls is covered in art, and to the point where they just kind of got it stacked everywhere that they had bought so much art. And it's one of the largest collections of modern American art that's ever been privately held. And it's worth millions and millions of dollars.
And it really is just an incredible dream for anyone who's very into art to just see pictures of where they lived with this just every inch covered. And
that, yeah, they had almost 5,000 pieces in their collection. 47, I'm sitting here looking at it, 40, just under 4,800 pieces of art that they had amassed over their decades of collecting. And it's a very sweet and charming story. which was their story, which was never referenced or acknowledged by Nicholas Sparks, ever. And the funny thing about that is, he has a rather extensive list of acknowledgments in the back of this book, where...
Over 3 pages of acknowledgments.
3 pages of acknowledgments. And he never once says, you know, this novel inspired by Herman Dorothy Vogel. It's, you know, references, thanks to Herman Dorothy Vogel for ripping off your life so that I can make a buck. But
no, in the author's note at the back of the book, he talks about the Black Mountain College referenced in it, where, you know, the fictional Ira and Ruth go to purchase a lot of their art. So he references that, sure. He references the artists themselves that, you know, his... He threw their names into the book for good measure. He even mentions a Christian parable in the back of his book.
That is the story of Luke and Sophia.
But nowhere in here is the Vogel.
Because that's mentioned. The other thing, is that then you get to the story of Luke and Sophia. And the more you read that, if you're somebody that has a mom with access to email and Facebook, you have been sent this story before. It's an actual parable that has made the rounds in the last decade. And I mean, some people call it a lot of different things. But, you know, it's basically there's a couple, there's a guy, and there's an old guy, and he dies and leaves the young person a bunch of wealth.
Yep.
So
but
that,
all for love.
All for love. And then their life is all better. So tell us about Luke and Sophia.
Oh, quick side note. Not only does he steal the Vogel story... And also use a parable for the Luke and Sophia story. He also uses a parable in the book of Sophia and Luke talking that my own father has told me. It's that common of a parable.
Yes.
About, like, oh, the man who goes out fishing every day. And because he loves it, he builds up a fleet of fishing boats and makes tons of money so that he can retire and live in the same kind of cottage he had when he originally started out and go fishing every day. Like, that's... These are just these overly common, just... The parables that your mom emails you.
Yes. That's
thinking,
what I'm
saying. Like, isn't anybody this just the sweetest?
With email and access to Facebook has pretty much read this novel already.
Yes, and there's, like, a gif of a heart, like, pumping at the bottom. And,
I
like,
just
smiling.
Imagine it's one of those old, like, angel pages or whatever those were with the spinning, sparkly gifs.
But it's that. It's these, like, just...
The
really
longest ride.
Cute and schmaltzy and, oh, and look, and then they had all this money and they rode off into the sunset together.
So so we have Luke and Sophia, and Luke, has a dark, dark secret. He's dark, he's troubled, and he's brooding, and he's got a dark secret. He has an injury from his rodeo time.
Because, of course.
Because, so he's got an injury.
Because you would never expect a bull rider to get an injury.
So he's got this injury, right? And what happens is, if he gets hit real hard... He might die.
Which is really true of anyone.
I mean...
To be fair,
if I went and got on a bull...
You would die.
I would die.
You would die.
I would die.
You would definitely die.
I would very, very die.
We would both die.
I mean...
We are not bull people.
No! No! We are not! Other people have, like, Great Danes, and they're big animal people. I'm a Pomeranian. I'm a little animal person. Little animal. Not a bull. No bull.
But the bull that trampled him is sort of the crux of their, you know, common Hallmark misunderstanding moment. Where, oh, the couple, it's been so wonderful up till now. And then this comes out and they get upset with each other because he refuses to stop bull riding. Oh, and it's not that he refuses to stop because he's, you know, addicted to thrills or is like an adrenaline junkie or... You know, wants to be the very best. It's no, he has to earn money to keep his mom's farm.
You said want to be the very best, and the Pokemon theme song started playing in my head.
But because he's, it's not that, oh, he wants,
very best.
It's so unrealistic.
No,
he's not.
Never was. Herman Cain, shout out, Herman Cain.
But it's not like their big issue is because of a personality flaw. It's, oh, well, he's just such a devoted, loving son, and he wants to save the farm for his mother.
So we have Sophia.
Yes.
We have Sophia, who conveniently is getting her degree in art history.
this, that was really convenient.
Very convenient that she has this useless art history degree that she's just going, I just don't know what I'm going to do with this art history degree. When is this ever going to help me? I also happen to be fluent in like 5 languages.
Four. One of them English.
I am fluent in 4 languages and I'm an art historian. When is this ever going to help me? Like,
oh,
yeah. Really?
Oh, and also they do happen to live right near where Ira and Ruth did.
Yes. So Sophia has the most cartoonishly awful ex-boyfriend.
He's just picked like stereotypical ex-boyfriend out of the drawing pile. Oh, well, it's the mean jock who cheats on his girlfriend.
Right. It's Mr. Drunk Frat Guy. Hey, Drunk Frat Guy, how you doing?
I don't even have to give him a name. You can just say her Drunk Frat Guy ex.
Did they give him a name? Did he have a name?
Blake?
Of course it's Blake.
Blake or Blake, something with a B, I think. I don't
know. I'm kind of surprised it's not like, I don't know, Cole,
Brock.
Jason.
Brick.
I don't know, what's one of those like 3-syllable douche names?
I don't know, but it's just, the guy has no personality aside from, oh, well, he's a lacrosse player and he drinks. And
yeah, I mean, he's, oh, she's dating this awful drunk frat guy, and that's pretty
much... For 2 years.
Yeah.
They barely mention the fact that she's so bad at relationships, she spent 2 years with this guy.
And so, you know, the novel opens on Luke and Sophia meeting, instantly falling the most in love that any two people have ever fallen in love with.
But it's a Hallmark movie, so of course they meet by him rescuing her when she's being accosted by the drunk frat guy.
By drunk frat guy.
And he's just so cool as he does it. They don't even fight. He just, like, uses his momentum against him and then puts his boot on his head.
Yeah, like, step off. My dad's Clint Eastwood. Get away from me now. And then he's like, okay. And then drunk frat guy leaves forever. Instantly gone.
Until conveniently at the end.
We had a 2-year relationship. I'm just going to evanesce from your life. I am just going to become seafoam and go away.
Although it does make a little more sense that he goes away, seeing as how she then spends every waking minute over at Luke's farm afterwards.
So you have these two people, Luke and Sophia, who are just the most darling caricatures of every good, wholesome, Christian young person out there.
Oh, they even admit that it's too easy. Almost like, oh, well, I just trusted him instantly. We just had this connection. I don't know why, but I felt so comfortable. They don't even try to, like, give them something to talk
about.
And
Sophia and Luke both, I mean, they just have this very long inner monologue
with their
respective
selves. And they
find each other
fascinating. They're just fascinated with everything about the other.
They have this very long inner monologue with their respective selves, just about how each of them is just not into casual sex. And Nicholas Sparks wants us all to know that good young people just hate the idea of sex.
Oh, and she had
sex. It's disgusting.
She had sex with her drunk frat guy boyfriend.
But it was bad, and it was
unfulfulfilling, and she
felt
bad.
It was the worst. She felt bad as a woman.
And she wondered what her parents would think about her.
Oh, God. If ever it got out, man, what a Jezebel she would be.
That was ground in a little heavy.
And then there's Luke. Oh, I've had dalliances in the past. By golly.
But they've left me feeling empty.
Oh, sure, I had an one-night stand once or twice in the past, but, oh, buddy, I woke up and I just had to hug my Bible and get right with the Lord, don't you know?
And also,
do you love that voice?
Yes,
I think I'm gonna be that guy all weekend. I'm gonna go to the grocery store and talk to the cashier.
So we're not gonna be speaking for a week or two. But no, it's just, and it's not that these are terrible things if it was actually part of their character.
And here's the thing. I mean, I that says nothing. I mean, if you have that as a value, fine, great. I'm glad for you.
Sex is
a heavy emotional thing for you to do.
Yes,
and to do. I mean, to think about
it,
to contemplate.
The problem is with the portrayal of it. How heavily it's handed.
But my big issue with it was the hypocrisy of the whole thing. Because then 1 week after meeting, they go off to a cabin and spend the whole weekend
together
having sex.
Yes.
1 week after meeting.
Also, though, there is a lovely scene where they hold hands. And they both talk about how wonderful and magical it is and how it's so much more important and close and intimate than kissing.
You cannot tell us, Nicholas Sparks, this that is it is the kind so of terribly wrong to have sex outside of marriage and that you must be truly, truly in love with someone and all of this stuff. And then have your protagonists immediately hop in bed with each other and make us believe that it's sincere. They're infatuated, sure, but then you can't say that premarital sex is the worst thing because you just advocated for it, as long as you really think this person's nice.
Well, and you can't call it love when you've known the guy for a week.
I mean, again, infatuation, sure.
Yes, you can call it infatuation.
I think he's pretty. I think she's cute.
Maybe we do have a lot in common, but you can't call it love.
No.
She didn't even know that he'd nearly died recently.
No.
You can't call it love if you don't know.
Have they met family yet by that point? I don't think so.
I don't think he'd met her. I think she might have met his mother.
His mom, yeah, who plays a big part in the story of being his guilt trip.
Yeah, and doing pretty much nothing. Aside from that.
Barbara Streisand in that guilt trip movie with, who's it with? She is nowhere near as nagging of a mom as this mom is just so, I don't want you to do this, but I really need the money, but please don't go ride and make us money, but kind of need the money here, Luke. You know, if you could just not kill yourself, but wink, wink, not ride.
Yeah.
It's just...
The mom also has very little personality I'm the strong, independent mother who's depending on her younger, injured son to then go make her money.
Yeah, that's what I didn't understand, is that supposedly she's this incredibly savvy businesswoman who keeps this farm running and yada, 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 and she doesn't seem to actually have any kind of business savvy or any ability to make money.
Well, apparently she mortgaged the farm to pay for his vast medical bills. Okay.
Sure.
However.
And fine.
However, most hospitals understand you're not going to pay it all in one lump sum. And you can usually work out a payment plan of, this is how much you owe, but we will let you pay it off over this amount of time in these kinds of monthly installments.
But Kate, plot. You're forgetting. Plot. Okay, so we've got Luke and Sophia. They instantly fall more in love than two people have ever fallen in love with ever.
To be perfectly honest, this is Disney level of quick, like, I look into their eyes and we're soulmates.
Even Disney doesn't do it anymore. Elsa was like, you are not marrying somebody that you just married, Anna. And everybody was like, heck yeah, Elsa.
But this is like classic. Like we love Snow Disney White type here. Of, but I looked in their eyes and we're soulmates.
Oh gosh, golly, don't you know? You just got that soulmate stuff going on there. And I just, he's the squish to my ish. And the fact that
both of them keep saying, oh, I don't know that I'm looking for something serious when I'm clearly looking for someone to spend the rest of my life with. And her friend, the friend.
Oh, she does have a friend.
Her friend.
See, here's the thing. Other than Luke, Sophia, Ira, and Ruth.
All the other characters,
you don't even need their name. They could just be called drunk frat guy, token friend.
Oh, token.
Overbearing mother.
Token
like,
sorority sister friend.
Yes.
So, of course, she's taking her to instances where there's going to be drinking. Of course, she tells her she's moving too quick with this guy. Of course, she goes on and on about how attractive the new guy is. Because you have to establish to the reader, wow, he's really, really gorgeous, without the main girl having to say it, because she would never just objectify him like that.
So, the book goes on, I mean, and here's the thing. The reasons why, and it's because reasons, right? So the reasons why people are reading this book, because here's the thing, it has a 4.5 out of 5 star reader rating. On Goodreads. Now, I mean, I don't give a lot of credence to literary critics because I think that they can be hypercritical of things that are made for entertainment value only.
I would agree.
And, you know, movie critics as well. Movie critics will rate something very low that the majority of people will rank very high.
Well, because they're looking at overall brilliance, not, oh, well, it's just meant to be kind of funny and quick.
Right. Is, you know,
Not everyone wants to be
Citizen
Is
this film
Kane.
Schindler's List?
Yeah.
No, but I don't want to go to the theater and see Schindler's List every single time. Sometimes I just want to go munch some popcorn and look at pretty things, people, pretty people doing whiz-bang things with their crazy technology. Oh. Yeah.
Sorry, he was just doing the Groucho Marx, like, cigar.
So the reasons why people are reading this novel is it's heartwarming.
Which is a word that you see in almost every review. Heartwarming.
Literally every review. I cried. It's heartwarming. It reminds us all, you know, about the difficult decisions that we have to make. And
the importance of love and love conquering all.
It reminded me of when I fell in love. And the thing is, I do sympathize with that. I do. I mean, I like movies that and books and TV shows and stuff that give me a sense of nostalgia. I love it. I mean, I really do. And there's a place for that, I think. But to be perfectly honest, I think the reason that we're ripping this book apart is because I would like some kind of originality to it. And the problem with Nicholas Sparks is that at this point, he's become his own cliche. I mean, he's going to start off with an old person. It's going to flash to a young couple. The old person is going to die or leave or somehow vanish from the story in order to make the young people's lives better.
Well, and there's nothing wrong with having a story that's meant to just be sort of fun. In, like, the book equivalent of How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Something fun.
Right.
Like, oh, the couple's going to meet, you know, they're going to end up together in the end. But the fact that there's, again, nothing really original to the story. The
you
characters
pick up the novel,
bland.
The Devil Wears Prada, the novel The Devil Wears Prada. There's some uniqueness to it. There's some dynamic to it. And for what it is, and the audience it's aimed at, and what it's trying to do, it was unique enough and fun enough that, sure, it's a good summer beach read. You're going to sit by the pool, you're going to soak up some sun, or you're going to cover yourself in an umbrella and avoid the sun entirely and just enjoy the pretty people bringing you fruity beverages with umbrellas in them. And read a silly, fun story. And escape. Escapist literature is fine.
But this isn't fun.
It's not even fun
it's
because
dull.
It's its own cliche. Therefore, it becomes dull. And the problem is he uses the same literary tropes throughout. I mean, the idea, the entire reason the novel is named The Longest Ride is because he keeps referencing, Ira keeps referencing this quote. How does it go?
I pull open my handy copy
Well,
here.
It's basically this longest ride, the thing we call life.
Yes. Ira, speaking of his father, says, "His voice, even now, follows me everywhere on this longest of rides, this thing called life." It's just, it's not even
But
cheesy.
He says that about every three pages. I mean, they really do overuse the title in the story.
Well, but also the cliches. I mean, there's the guy and the girl who come from opposite walks of life. There's the old couple and, oh, well, he goes away to the war and comes back damaged. She's always wanted children, but he's unable to give them, but they make it work anyway, and he always regrets it. These are the kinds of story plots you have seen a million times and done much, much better.
And here's the thing. I think you can probably guess how the story ends. The old guy dies eventually, from injuries sustained from the car wreck in the beginning of the
Although
novel.
Although lasts a surprisingly long amount of time in that
car. A very long time in that car, in freezing temperatures.
He lasts an astonishing
like a couple of days, right?
Like an older gentleman with cancer who needs a walker to get around. Like,
well, Luke and
really
Sophia
lasts.
Happen to be driving, at the end of the novel, happen to be driving by this road.
Well, of course.
They see this guy who's been in this car that apparently nobody else has passed in like the 2 or 3 days that he has been sitting there on the side of the road, slowly dying, talking to his
ghost of his dead wife.
Dead wife. And they meet him. They take him to a hospital. He instantly falls in love with these two people.
Has Sophia read aloud the last letter that he wrote for Ruth on their upcoming anniversary.
Charming, sweet, cute, schmaltzy, fine. Again, sweet, but the thing is, this
but
guy...
But then Sophia also ends up going to the auction.
Right.
Of art stuff that happens to be his estate.
So he dies. All of his artwork, his 4,800 pieces, goes up for auction, or at least the big stuff does.
Oh, and it's incredible. It's, they keep saying it's this very secretive auction.
Yeah,
it's,
there's a surprise twist only to the auction, yeah.
Yet this art student, this art history.
Well, he made sure that those two were invited, because remember, he instantly thought of them as his children.
No, he didn't invite them.
Oh, I thought
one of her art professors invites her.
Oh, yeah.
So it's really just a coincidence that they end up there. It's not, which makes it even more unbelievable.
Woof.
It would have been more believable if he remembered their names and said, oh yes, invite them because I think they'll understand.
So they get to the auction. There's a painting at the very first painting up for auctions, this crappy little painting by a nobody artist that nobody wants to buy.
And it's an artist who was one of Ruth, you know, Ira's wife. It was her student.
Her art
who
student.
Who did a painting of her.
So Luke knew how much Sophia really wanted a painting. So he stands up and he buys it. And he's the only person to bid on it.
It's not just that he thinks she'll want it. It's, oh, well, I know how important Ruth was to Ira. This guy that I met this one time as he was dying. So I think I'll spend $400 on this picture.
But he was looking over it, Sophia, and, you know, going, Sophia,
like,
so,
all right, I'll buy that. But
I brought $500 with me, and she kind of laughs, because it's like, there's no way that you're going to buy, you know, a Jasper Johns for $500 or whatever. Which, by the way, I think is, like, the only artist that's ever referenced in this book.
No, they mention a few.
Jasper Johns.
No, they talk about Pollock and the de Koonings.
Oh, God. I swear, though.
Twombly gets kind of a
he really hits Jasper Johns home. I'm like, I get it, Nicholas Sparks. You know who Jasper Johns is. Congratulations. So, conveniently, the opening bid for this painting goes all the way down to
$500. $400.
Oh, whatever.
Let's go with facts.
Okay, so he buys it with all the money in his pocket, basically. Basically, the auctioneer goes, hey, random guy over there, how much do you have in your pocket? And Luke goes, 50 cents. And he's like, yeah, how about that? You want a painting for 50 cents? Fine, sure.
Oh, no. And then Nicholas Sparks goes on to make sure that you know, oh, and all of the expensive art critic people, they're just kind of talking while this painting's getting auctioned.
Yes.
This is that worthless painting. No one's paying attention.
And then plot twist.
Oh, no. Typical Hallmark movie. You could almost hear the hush. You could see this in your mind as a Hallmark scene. This big art gallery, they're auctioning off these famous paintings. And then the attorney for Ira comes up and goes, and I'm going to read his will for how this is to go. The person who bought the painting of Ruth. Yes, lone, heartfelt stranger in the back. Could you stand, please? You tall man with the cowboy.
You get all the paintings! And you get all the rest of the paintings. You get all the paintings. You cowboy in the back, you get all the paintings.
And you can hear all of the art.
And then there's a big hullabaloo.
In their business suits going like, most unusual, how dare you.
I'll call my lawyer. Do
most
that.
Most unorthodox.
Bait and switch. So, and then Luke and Sophia are instant quabillionaires.
Oh, and he happens to hire the attorney and art caretaker Ira used, because of course they must be good, trustworthy people.
Well, yeah, I mean, he goes in the back and he says, well, you're gonna need an attorney. He says, well, do you want to be my attorney? He's like, sure. So,
and this is why this cowboy should not be in charge of millions and millions and millions of dollars.
And so, and the novel closes and they live happily ever after. And I mean, again, the problem isn't that it's heartwarming. The problem for me is it good?
No.
Is it good? And
no.
And I, it's just not. It's not, because it wasn't unique to its own self. I mean, it takes the worst parts of other Nicholas Sparks ideas and just sticks them all together and creates a story out of it. And the problem is, it's not even a story that was his to create. So here at Because Reasons, we always like to give you some alternatives. So if you were to read a different story and you wanted to read another romance, but it were something like this, but actually good, what would you recommend? I think, for me, I would recommend going and seeing the documentary Herb and Dorothy. You can buy it for $9.99 on iTunes. You can probably rent it for a whole lot less than that. It might even be on Netflix, I'm not sure, but it came out a few years ago, and it's the actual, truly interesting, scintillating story of Herb and Dorothy Vogel, you know, their love story, how they created this artwork. And there's actually a follow-up documentary, Herb and Dorothy 50 by 50 or something like that. And so there's a follow-up documentary that takes place after that. So you can watch two movies. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, read the story, watch the story of the actual people. And I find it much more interesting because it's, you know, it really happened. Sometimes the real is much better than the fantastic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it made for something new and unique and interesting, you know.
Well, and those are great recommendations. Or just say you're really into art. Go pick up some art biographies. Find an artist that you really love and, oh, I want to know more about their life. Or if you just want, like, cheap, fun, romantic movies, there are hundreds more out there that are bound to be better.
Well, but here's the thing. If you want to do a Nicholas Sparks novel, I wouldn't recommend this being your first one. And now if you're a diehard Nicholas Sparks fan and this is your cup of tea and you want to read it because you just want to read all the things by Nicholas Sparks, I mean, if I know a new Dan Brown novel is coming out, I'm going to probably buy it. It's a Robert Langdon Dan Brown novel. I'm buying it. It's fun. It's a good, interesting story. And the plot twist is always satisfactory. It's always a crazy plot twist. You're always going, that Dan Brown. But it's always fun. And it's, you know, it's a breakneck ride through whatever European country Dan Brown has decided to place some giant nuclear Holocaust bomb thing. But if you want to do a Nicholas Sparks novel, try some of his earlier work. I think it's much, much better than what, you know, he's become as an author. You know, he's not really an author anymore so much as, you know, kind of the CEO of Nicholas Sparks Incorporated, who's trying to create the next movie, product tie-in, yada, yada, yada. So go and read The Notebook. Go and read, you know, a Walk to Remember or something like that. So read some of his earlier work. It's much better. It's unique. It's novel. It's new. And it's still a sweet, heartwarming romance.
No, I think those are good recommendations. And again, it's not that it's the worst book ever. If somebody asked, I wouldn't say, you know, it's not unbearably bad writing. It's a little weird that no one speaks in contractions, but it's not, you know, it's not some, you know, seventh grader's creative writing attempt. It's okay. But the biggest problem is you're not going to get a lot of new or interesting ideas out of this one.
No.
It's not the kind of love story that's going to stand the test of time as being a classic.
No.
If you want classic romance, go to something more like Pride and Prejudice or Jane Eyre, which even though they're not the best role models, at least they're really interesting characters.
To be fair, you know, are the reasons valid? Is it a heartwarming story? Is it sweet? Is it nostalgic? Is it any of that? I mean, I'd say it's maybe halfway there. I mean, it's nostalgic for the times when Nicholas Sparks was a good writer. You know, it makes you, you know, think about a time that might have been, or, you know, but the problem for me is that it's almost my problem with Superman. It's just the image is just too squeaky clean for me.
Yes.
And the people never really go through any kind of tribulation. You know,
well,
their
fight is just, oh, well, you held something back from me, but you're doing it to save your mom. Oh, well, I've decided I'm going to stop doing it at the end.
Right. I mean, it's, they're two far too perfect people that meet in a very perfect situation.
And fall in love way too easily.
Fall in love way too easily. And I would prefer a story that makes you work for it a little bit. That there's some push and pull and some real stuff that happens.
Well, or deep, meaningful reasons right. as to why they're in love.
Yeah. If it's going to be a love story to me, I need it to actually, you know, make me feel like these two are fully actualized characters, first of all. And that the people surrounding them are more than just drunk frat guy.
And
overbearing.
Oh, that one friend.
That one friend. Sorority
friend.
Luke has
no friends, by the way. They never mention a friend.
Not one friend.
None.
That is one lonely cowboy.
He spends all of his time with his mother.
And his, oh, that mom.
Yeah.
That mom.
Who also doesn't seem to have friends.
Do you disagree with us? Do you want to go on the longest ride, this thing we call life? We'd love to hear from you. You can actually tweet us.
Woohoo.
You can tweet us. You can tweet us your recommendations. We would love to hear from you. You can tweet us at ReasonsCast. Let us know your recommendations. Let us know what you thought of The Longest Ride. And actually, we are now on Facebook.
Woohoo!
Facebook.com/BecauseReasonsPodcast.
With some fun cartoon images of us.
Yes. So let us know what you thought of The Longest Ride. Post to our Facebook. Tweet us on Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. But we're probably going to go, because we've got a long ride ourselves. It's the longest ride. We've got to get on this long... It is this thing called life. How'd you know?
Is this thing called life going to take us past a Starbucks?
Yes! Yes, it is.
Because I need something to stay awake for this.